All right, ladies, buckle up.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
Good morning and welcome to the 51st episode of Matinee Talk. I am one of your hosts, Johnny Lightfoot, with me as always,
Julian Owens.
And also joining us for the second Matinee Talk in a row is our guest,
Brett Leipziger. Pleasure to be here.
Very cool. So today our main topic is going to be talking Tenet, but we do have some little mini reviews. Julian's going to do a little rant about the New Mutants. Brett and I'll talk a minute or two about Bill and Ted Face the Music. But first, we'll get into a little news, some sad news, the unfortunate passing of Chadwick Boseman. So, gentlemen, rest in power, Mr. Boseman, suffering from cancer the last 4 years, unknowns to most people, hit it well. Any thoughts on the actor, the person?
I will say, just coming from somebody who's black and watching him since 42, which was released in, I want to say, 2013. Yes, in 2013, when he played Jackie Robinson in Harrison Ford, I've been watching him since then. Watching him grow his career and being this pivotal actor, black actor, when he went from 42 to Get On Up, Draft Day, and then when he got his titular role as T'Challa in Civil War, and then becoming Black Panther, then Endgame and Infinity War, just something that I've always loved and something that I was admired to, because I would say in my lifetime, I haven't seen a black actor hit that kind of run in a span of 5 to 7 years like that. You know what I'm saying? Denzel's done it, you know. Lawrence Fishburne has done that kind of run, but in my lifetime, no actor has hit that kind of run except Chadwick Boseman. And seeing what the cultural phenomenon that is Black Panther, whether we're not going to get into how I feel about the film, but how that film has become a cultural impact was something that I just was amazed to see, and seeing people come together and just celebrate a black superhero that Blade couldn't even do, you know, and like Storm couldn't even do in the X-Men films, and seeing Chadwick take that mantle and going above and beyond was something that was amazing. And to your point, it's amazing that his circle didn't even ounce in a word about what was going on with him. He was stage 3 colon cancer when he was filming Black Panther. Not many people can say that they were battling cancer while being a titular superhero. And for him to battle that with, you know, going through Black Panther, Civil War, and all those other Marvel films was something I would say is courageous. And I feel like that's what we're going to live off on, or that's what we're going to see his legacy come to be fruition. It's not the fact that he died of colon cancer, that the fact that he was fighting stage 3 colon cancer by being one of the black superheroes in the MCU was something that I would say lives on to legacy. And like you said, rest in power, Chadwick. I love what he's done for the film industry and what he can do for black actors moving forward.
Brett?
Yeah, I mean, clearly with the reaction, I mean, this was a man that just all around him, people wanted to be around him, you know, and we're not just talking about actors, like Kamala Harris. Yeah. Had great notes to say about him and her interaction with him. It's also, too, he was an actor that wasn't afraid of these big roles. I mean, playing Jackie Robinson, doing a James Brown, coming into, you know, Black Panther and everything that's there. You know, I think you hit a note there by saying, you know, kind of playing Black Panther while battling stage 3. I mean, colon cancer, some actors can't even handle just doing, you know, a superhero part like that. Yes. That will destroy you just physically, mentally enough. But to be like doing that, you know, while battling cancer and like everything that being in that Marvel machine is, it speaks to, you know, certainly the man that he was, but just that work ethic as well. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking then, you know, seeing you know, some of those videos that were floating around about him, you know, talking about children battling cancer on the Black Panther press tour. It's heartbreaking, but it also, you know, it is uplifting because this was a strong man, and this is how he decided to live, you know, those very, you know, troublesome years that you know, certainly I'm sure he was battling with the cancer, but, you know, he chose to be just a bright, shining star, and I think we're all better for it.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And it's what's really great about the work he did, especially playing these great historical figures, and then also, you know, one of the most empowered Black superheroes, is, you know, gone but not forgotten. I think, you know, generations, that's one of the great things about art in general, whether it's cinema or music or art in the traditional sense, painting, drawing, things, sculpting, that stuff's never forgotten. And generations of people will be able to go back and have their kids and their grandkids watch these roles that Chadwick played, and played so well that, you know, he was identified at a very, you know, young age.
Yeah.
You know, Julian spoke of Denzel, and Denzel didn't even know that it was his contribution that put Chadwick through acting school. And, you know, that speech that he gave to Denzel is a remarkable speech. If you haven't seen it, I'm sure you can find it on YouTube, where he basically thanks Denzel, and Denzel didn't even know who he was or that his money went towards, you know, financing and putting this man into his career, and him coming back later on and saying, thank you, you were me, and Denzel kind of joking around saying, okay, well, now that you made it, you can go ahead and pay me back. But in Denzel's mind, he wanted to push it forward, because in Denzel's mind, you know, it even took, he skyrocketed, right, but it took him a significantly longer time than Chadwick. Chadwick, I mean, he rose like a comet, superstar. Denzel had to do a lot more supporting roles at first, and same thing, Lawrence Fishburne, even Morgan Freeman, you know, he had to come up, and it took him a while. Chadwick, it seemed like, was going to be one of those shining stars we saw in the acting world for a long time. And, you know, like Brett said, even towards the end, still visiting children with cancer to be T'Challa, be Black Panther for these children, I think is a testament to the type of man, not just great actor, but great man he was. And like we all said, you know, rest in power, Chadwick Boseman. It's a great loss for the film industry, and he will be missed.
Surely missed, yeah.
All right. With that said, a little solemn news to start us off, but we were going to get the energy going up. How are we going to get that energy going up? Julian saw a movie that Brett and myself both had no shame in saying that neither of us have touched, and I'm probably not going to see it until it hits Disney Plus at some point, and I'll watch it then just to see what kind of train wreck it took. Took 4 years for this to come out, and a pandemic.
Uh-huh.
And if not for the contract Disney had with Fox, I'm sure it would have been Disney Plus all the way. For those who don't know, when Disney acquired Fox, basically any film that was completed during those negotiations had to be released theatrically, which is why we get Mulan on Disney Plus and we get New Mutants in the theaters. Without further ado, Julian, tell us about New Mutants.
Oh God. What to begin with? Oh God. All right. So I'll put it this way. Again, like Johnny said, this is directed by Josh Boone. It was a 20th Century Fox, now 20th Century Studios, as we all know it's called now, was a film that was going to basically coincide with the X-Men franchise that was going on with 20th Century Fox, right? And this film basically talks about a group of kids, you know, in this facility, I'm using air quotes right now, that basically is supposed to help them get better, understand their mutant powers and basically become better people. And as you probably can tell from the trailers, that is not what this hospital, quote unquote, is going to be about. That is the basic generic synopsis I'm gonna give you about this film. Oh my God, everybody who was in this film was a waste of talent. I mean, absolutely a waste of talent. Maisie Williams was the top bill of this film, and she literally sounded, she made a Russian accent. I don't know if you heard that in the trailers, but she was a Russian accent. And when I say, oh my God, can you shut up with this Russian accent? That's what I got from Miss Williams. Like, don't get me wrong. You did the best you could with the script that you got, but Miss Williams, I was tired of this Russian accent. Anya Taylor-Joy does the exact same thing. And I'm like, please, guys, look. These are two phenomenal actors, Maisie coming from Game of Thrones and Anya Taylor-Joy coming from her own reign in terms of just like The Witch. What's the movie with James McAvoy? What am I thinking about? Split. Like, you've come from phenomenal acting points, and I'm
Thoroughbreds.
Right, Thoroughbreds, another great film, and you're like, your acting chops are there. What the hell happened in this movie? And,
Earlier this year.
And to my point, it came out earlier this year. And for this film to be filmed during 2017, and 3 years later, you have this, I call it the worst, not worst, second to almost third worst X-Men film of all time come out. And you're like, yeah, we're just going to release it, see what's going to happen. It was bad. We talked about it on this podcast before. We felt like New Mutants should have been on FX, Disney Plus, something like that. And I'm gonna be honest with you folks, you should wait till when it comes to those streaming services. This movie is not worth $20 to go see. Like, I was like, oh well, this is the first movie I'm gonna see at Alamo Drafthouse. Side note, for anybody who is watching movies going into theaters and trying to worry about COVID-19, I will say Alamo Drafthouse is probably one of the safest ones out of all of them. We'll talk about that later when we get into when we get into Tenet. But watching it, I'm sitting there like, why did I waste $80 to watch this movie? Yes, I went on a date and it was just like, I wasted money on this. I absolutely did. And I'm sitting there like, wow, I thought Dark Phoenix was bad. No, this is bad. This is garbage. The special effects, as we talked about, he had 3 years to do this and this is what we got. Okay, acting chops, the accents are terrible. Wow, okay, it's another Breakfast Club, but instead it's in a insane asylum. Oh, and spoiler alert, sorry for anybody who's saying, I'm saying it right now for the New Mutants, this is a spoiler alert. Oh my God, the Essex Corporation is up behind all this. Oh my God. If you've seen Logan, you know who they are. They're basically a group of people who are using kids or using people who have mutant powers and using them for weapons. That's all you need to know about them. And they try to make a dun 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 reveal for it. I'm like, guys, we knew who they were. Can you just move on with the movie? And it was, oh, it was so annoying. And I will say, I don't understand why they think that this will be a trilogy or they were going to make a second film out of this. No, one and done. I'm sorry, guys. This is not a spinoff we need to do. This is definitely a movie you need to stop. Like, absolutely. Everything about this was bad. This is either the third worst or the second worst X-Men movie of all time. Don't go watch this until it's on streaming. I stamp of my approval.
As someone who waited until Dark Phoenix was, I don't know, it was on streaming for a couple months on HBO before I was finally like, and this was in the middle of the COVID shutdown, and I was like, I'm bored, it's 10 in the morning. Why not? And, and if this is just as bad or worse, I don't feel any shame in not contributing money.
So let me ask this for both of you guys, Brent and Johnny. For Dark Phoenix, because I'm having an argument with somebody at this moment. For Dark Phoenix, as much as this is a bad movie, like it was for Last Stand, were there moments in the movie where you're like, huh, that's interesting. I liked what you did with that. But again, the movie overall is terrible. But I liked maybe one or two moments from the Dark Phoenix. Did you have any moments like that in Dark Phoenix?
I don't think I had a moment like that. I will say the difference granted, I haven't seen New Mutants, not planning on seeing it for a while, but I will say the main difference on paper, at least, is the talent. I mean, you talk about how Williams and Taylor Joy, they've got some talent, but I mean, the talent involved in Dark Phoenix is there.
Yes.
And Simon Kinberg has been a part of that X-Men franchise for years. I mean, he's worked with these actors before, not as director, but he's been a part of this, and that's why when he was initially locked in as director, I was like, interesting for a first time job. But yeah, I mean, you had all the talent there, you had all the story there. You're coming off of Apocalypse, which was not good. So in my thought process was you can only go up from here, but they didn't. They failed on that, and I won't preach any more about Dark Phoenix. Any thoughts, Brett, on New Mutants? Or
let me ask this also for both of you guys. You can say a quick answer on this, Johnny. Was it better than The Last Stand? Yes or no?
I actually just went through an X-Men marathon over the last couple days.
Uh-huh.
And I've been doing that a lot while dealing with family stuff. But yeah, I went in order. So X-Men,
oh, God.
X-Men, X2, Last Stand, Wolverine Origins,
oh, God.
First Class, then
I would say Wolverine.
The Wolverine.
Yeah, Wolverine.
Then Days of Futures Past, then Apocalypse, then
Deadpool 2?
Deadpool 2, then Logan.
And then
I didn't watch Dark Phoenix again because I saw that like 4 months ago. And I'm not going to watch it again. But I'll say it. Brett Ratner's Last Stand is better than Dark Phoenix.
Okay. All right.
I would think like I'm probably going to take like the story and just like the narrative drive of Last Stand. I mean, I think the only thing that Dark Phoenix has going for it is just like the cast that they already have signed to it is really awesome and solid. And, you know, I think they're all good in their roles. Like the things that I'm like interested in with New Mutants and looking at that now is like one, like how do you feel now about Josh Boone doing what he's doing, The Stand on CBS All Access, like huge property. Like, and I'm not a Stephen King person, but I do know that that is an important property within the Kingverse.
I agree. Yes.
And I am a Stephen King person. Mm-hmm. And I think the Stephen King adaptations, both television and movies over the last several years have been on the upswing.
Right.
So I really don't
there's
want
more swings
something.
Than misses.
Yeah. Yes. I really don't want something like The Stand to kind of put some bumps in the road on that Stephen King adaptation.
Right. Because, yeah, we've had this, like, second coming of, like, understanding Stephen King is, like, yeah.
If you take the source material mm-hmm. and you understand it, I mean, we had Dr. Sleep. We had It.
Great.
And It Chapter 2.
Chapter 2 could have been better, but I understand.
Gerald's Game mm-hmm. on yes. Netflix was amazing.
Yeah.
And then more recently you had The Outsider on HBO,
right.
which was really, really solid.
Really
they
solid.
They changed the ending a bit, but I don't mind
yeah.
because okay. it's solid. The Mr. Mercedes yeah. television show,
and
solid.
To your point, one of the only misses, I would say, out of Stephen King's adaptations was the Tallgrass film that was on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only miss that we have of Stephen King.
Right.
And to your point, what Josh Boone has done with New Mutants, whenever you see it, I'm like, are you guys sure you got the right guy to do The Stand? Can we like backtrack on this? Like, that's how bad it was. But go ahead, Brett.
Well, yeah, and then I guess the other thing that I'm interested in New Mutants and hearing is like, certainly I think this was a bit of a gamble from Fox at the time, because from what I've seen, it seems like we're getting like it's a haunted house film, right?
In a sense, yes.
And is it like, I guess, like, are the stakes still like superhero stakes where they're trying to save the world and there's a giant blue beam? Like, is it that sort of bad, or like, is it just we're not getting like the characters? It sounds like don't click.
I feel like, and this is as much non-spoiler as I can try to do with this film. I feel like they really didn't do enough in terms of character development. That's one of the biggest things, right? So, you know, where there's those films that you see nowadays where you're like, wow, you're doing your character development at the end of the movie. Now you expect me to care at the end of the movie. That's what happens with the New Mutants. I feel like Josh kind of took the 3X structure and tried to flip it on its head with this film when we all know this is a Breakfast Club with mutants and a sane asylum. Like, I don't need more. I don't need more. I don't need some all of a sudden great story change with this. And I feel like that's what Josh tried to do with the New Mutants. And that's why it panned, and why it's one of the worst X-Men reviewed films of all time, because he tried to change the story of the Breakfast Club. I was sitting there like, oh, wow, this is the Breakfast Club just with a controlled substance. It's not just one day in detention. It's multiple months basically saying, if you don't know your power, you're going to stay here for a while. And we're going to use you and then test you. And all of a sudden, ooh, something that's happening in their past is coming back to haunt them. Ew. And it's like, you didn't give me enough background to be like, oh, I care about the fact that you got this going on. Or, hey, I care that you did X, Y, and Z with X, Y, and Z. It's just like, bro, can you move on? I don't care. So I would say yes, but definitely no.
Let me ask y'all two one more question in terms of New Mutants. Does this strengthen, or like, do you think Kevin Feige kind of loves the fact that now he gets to take over the X-Men and the property, essentially Fox sank it within the last four years.
Yes.
Yeah, just absolutely torpedoed that franchise with three absolute bombs in a row. And now Feige can come in and just be like, all right, now it's my turn with these toys.
Yeah, I agree. No, absolutely.
Like, he knew what he was getting himself into. He knew, for some odd reason, that 20th Century Fox, or 20th Century Studios, again, however you want to call them, knew that they were going on a train wreck for Dark Phoenix and the New Mutants. And he was just like, I know you guys don't want to see this as your X-Men films, but it's okay. This is the garbage that you guys are going to get. By 2025, 2026, you're going to have the X-Men films that you wanted, okay? Okay, let's get it on. Like, I feel like that's what Kevin Feige did.
That's interesting, yeah. I certainly feel like it's like Disney doesn't need any, like, layups, and essentially Fox was just like, oh, here's a layup. We're torching this property, and now you guys can reinvent it and be the heroes again for X-Men.
But yeah, that's all my right. Takes on New Mutants.
All right, so real quick, before we get into our main topic, Tenet, which will take up the majority of the show, Brett and I both saw Bill and Ted Face the Music. Brett, before we talk for just, I don't know, like less than 10 minutes on this, what were your thoughts? Because you and I both grew up, you know, we were probably young adolescents, preteens, when Excellent Adventure and Bogus Journey came out. How do you feel about those two?
They were definitely VHSs that I wore out. You know, just the kind of, like, you know, certainly I didn't get per se like the stoner comedy in it, but definitely just, you know, kind of two bros wanted to play music, and kind of, you know, wanted to just kind of survive. But certainly, like, all the catchphrases, that was absolutely part of my vernacular as a kid. I was probably too one of those where, like, the second one, Bogus Journey, was probably the one I liked more as a kid.
I'll agree.
Dealing with, I mean, I wouldn't say, though, that they were films that, like, impacted me as I was starting to kind of come into myself as like a film viewer. I'll certainly say I didn't do any sort of pre-watch going into Face the Music. I just kind of watched it cold, and I probably haven't watched the two previous Bill and Ted movies in, I'll say, 20 years is probably a good estimate. But yeah, how about yourself?
Like you, like, when I was young adolescent, preteen, those two VHSs were a part of my repertoire. And I have fond memories of them, and yeah, same thing. Like, Bogus Journey, little crazier, less to do with, you know, school and history, which made it more interesting. You had these cyborg versions of Bill and Ted who are like the evil versions, but they act exactly the same. Bill and Ted have to go find their own. And then you've got Death, who is just awesome. And I think he's one of the most positive parts of the new film as well. And we'll get into that. But yeah, I mean, excellent adventure, in my opinion. Going back and doing a rewatch, literally, I rewatched Bogus Journey first, then went back and watched Excellent Adventure the night before watching Face the Music. And I can, you know, Excellent Adventure is it's a cult favorite for a reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, it built Keanu Reeves from the beginning, and I mean, he got to play himself as a young man, and I'll go into a little bit about him as an older man playing Ted Theodore Logan. But yeah, those are my thoughts on the original. What did you give what was your grade on Face the Music?
On Face the Music, I was a three stars out of five. I liked it. I would recommend it. I think it's, you know, it's an easy watch. Also too, you know, I think we're all searching for sometimes just that kind of lighter fare, something that just,
yeah,
I don't have to do a lot of like mental gymnastics to watch this. I don't have to go to a dark place. I'm like, just kind of a joyful movie.
Yeah, and I'm of the same sentiment. And this was my reintroduction into the cinema in terms of the current COVID situation. Draft House, as Julian opened, has reopened with strict guidelines. So far, only two of their theaters here in Austin are open. But I do really like the things they're doing in terms of masks if you're not eating, the seat spacing. Literally every single person as they're entering the building gets a temperature check. You're ordering your food in advance, so it's coming into go cartons. I was in an early like free screening, and this was kind of like Lakeline's test run. Mm-hmm. So I kind of got lucky in that sense, in that my ticket for me and my girlfriend were free. So literally I just prepaid for our food and drinks, and we both like made the conscious decision, hey, we're going to go to this. If at any point either of us feels uncomfortable, guess what? It's already in a to-go container and no money lost. We just get up and bounce. So that was really good, but the experience was great. Good spacing. But in terms of the film itself, yeah, lighthearted fare, under 90 minutes. Death is great. I do think between Bill and Ted, I think Alex Winter seemed to have an easier time getting back into the Bill character, which is crazy to me because Keanu kind of is Ted. And it seemed like, you know, maybe him playing John Wick for so long that he's having a little trouble getting back into that gnarliness, and he's still a little stoic.
Yeah, it was weird because I had similar thoughts, and it looked like Keanu was like sore. Like it just didn't look like he was as comfortable as Alex was in those old clothes. Like, yeah, it just the mannerisms, just kind of how he was kind of presenting himself, because we've watched him be just this amazing athlete essentially for the last couple of years with the John Wick trilogy. And this, I was just like, he looks awkward here.
Yeah. And what's crazy about that is that the two daughters, they're essentially playing copies of their father. Mm-hmm. And as much as I love Samara Weaving, I thought she was the weaker of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of the girl's name who plays Ted's daughter, Billy. But I thought she basically must have just watched a bunch of tape of Keanu Reeves and was just like, I'm just going to play Keanu Reeves. Because even like her mannerisms, like the way she was moving around in her head, she was just playing Keanu Reeves more than Keanu was playing Keanu Reeves.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with you there. Certainly, yeah, that kind of the opening scene really allows you to kind of get used to the daughter characters. And right away, Billy, my eyes were on her, and just the mannerisms and kind of that overall performance. She was definitely living in something.
Yeah. So, I mean, overall, solid, easy watch, fun. I thought the final song, the song to save the world, was kind of dope.
Kind of dope.
Kid Cudi's there.
Ooh, okay.
Playing Kid Cudi. And so, I mean, overall, I think it's a really fun watch. I mean, the movie was probably made for like $15 to $20 million.
Well, and this is something like...
The effects are not great.
Was this a better decision to have this, like, because they also had the home video release, and that's how I watched it. I think they were benefited from having this kind of split release.
I do too.
I do think that if this just would have been a theatrical release,
yeah,
and like, you know, hindsight and without COVID, I think this movie gets torn apart a little bit more, or not torn apart, maybe just kind of forgotten. It doesn't get its moment to kind of be what it is, which is just, yeah, this nice, light kind of, you know, reintroduction to these characters. And, you know, coming out of it, I you know, if they want to make more Bill and Ted movies or follow the daughters, I'm there. Yeah. Easy.
No, 100%. And I also give it 3 out of 5. All right. Well, that being said, we will get on to our main review. We'll be talking about Christopher Nolan's Tenet. We'll also have a new episode of The Armchair Fits. Brett and I breaking down some Nolanisms later. But first, we'll get into our Tenet review right after this message from a sponsor. And we're back. We're going to be talking Christopher Nolan's Tenet. We're going to do some non-spoiler reviews. We will let you know ahead of time as soon as we get into spoilers. So with that being said, Julian, I have not talked to you about Tenet at all. I've talked to Brett a little bit because we wanted to save it. Thoughts?
Wow. I wouldn't put it in his top tier films, right? We're not putting it in Christopher Nolan's top tier films, but I hate to say this. I don't know if you agree with me, but I said it when we were talking before the podcast that I think you guys would agree with me. This is one of the best films of 2020. Christopher Nolan, I don't know what it is. He's has this infatuation with time for some apparent reason. He loves time, and I don't understand it. From Interstellar, Dunkirk, to now Tenet. I don't know what it is. Him and time just got some one-on-one relationship that they really just love with each other. And he does, even though he cops out, we'll talk about that later, he cops out in certain ways with this film. But even with this cop out, you're like, okay, I know what I'm getting myself into. Let's roll with it, you know? And even though there are certain things about this film that I just wish was better, this film was still very entertaining. It was great, an easy follow through, and I enjoyed almost every moment of this ride, and I enjoyed what John David Washington and Robert Pattinson is, which, again, we're going to wait. I'm going to wait to talk about this, but great performances from a spy film that talks about time and inverting time. And so for me, I think it's one of the best films of 2020. I don't know if I'm going to feel the same way with a second watch, but definitely right now, it is top 5, top 2, and I'm going to be one of those people. Number 2 for right now on where I feel with Tenet right now. What about you guys?
Yeah, so I think when I'm looking at Tenet, I was definitely like in my head that whole movie and just like trying to do the kind of mental gymnastics that Nolan's films can oftentimes put you through.
Yes.
So I'm definitely like trying to figure out what the heck is going on. I'm trying to start to, you know, figure out, okay, time inversion. Okay, this is how this scene is playing with it, which I think can sometimes get in the way of a viewing experience. I'm completely with you where I was entertained the whole time.
Yes.
You know, 2+ hour runtime. I'm chugging along. I'm feeling good. Third act comes around. I'm like, I want more. I really want to get to know this world more.
Mm-hmm.
I think you certainly kind of have that sense with, you know, something like Inception, where you leave that and you're like, oh, when can we go back to that world again? Like,
yes.
I want to see more adventures of really anybody in this Tenet world. It's, you know, for me, the film is really surprising just because, you know, again, all the stuff beforehand where Nolan just wants this to open up theaters again for everybody. I came out and I was just like, I don't know that the average film goer is going to like enjoy this process of watching this movie that like doesn't make a lot of sense, doesn't hold your hand a whole lot. And the kind of the bondness of it, I think, was something that initially first came out when the movie was getting announced, that this was kind of him doing Bond. It didn't cross, like, it wasn't in my mind kind of weeks leading up to it. And then during the viewing, it was really kind of post me like putting it together again in my head and being like, oh, okay, this is again Nolan ticking off a box, you know, a checklist of like career things he wants to do. And so it was like, okay, Nolan wants to do a Bond film. Did I like his Bond film? Yeah, yes. Yeah, it's certainly entertaining. I guess just the other kind of quick initial impression too is it's weird for me to then look at a film and be like, yeah, I dug it. I liked it. I'm at like a 3.5 star kind of out of 5 right now on it. And then say like, oh, well, it's you know, bottom half of his filmography. And to me, that's just crazy that like in a bottom half of a filmography, I still have something that's like audacious above and original.
Average. Yes.
It's his filmography is just insane in that like, you know, you can, you know, try to rip apart his movies for, you know, X, Y, or Z reasons, but like he's still just this guy that like is delivering these huge entertaining movies to us. And, you know, well, what more could you want from a filmmaker that's doing that kind of stuff? Like I'm certainly like I was more jazzed to see that than I'm going to be, you know, sitting down to Wonder Woman next month and Mulan, you know, Black Widow, like the other big movies.
Bond.
Yeah. And Bond. Yeah.
Oh, like, yeah. No Time to Die comes out.
That's right. Months. And like, essentially those feel like the big movies that we're going to get, like that feel like 100% those are happening this year. And yeah, I mean, Tenet's the best of, you know, at least that right now. And yeah, like I have it in my top 5. And yeah, how about yourself, Johnny?
So I came out of it initially and I'm the only one here who saw it twice. I saw it once on Wednesday night, and then I went back again on Tuesday afternoon by myself to kind of do a rewatch. And I gave it a 4 right out of the bat. It's not because I initially felt it was an honest 4. I did honestly think it was probably closer to somewhere between a 3 and a 3.5.
Okay.
But I felt like it left enough to be desired that I would pick up on a second viewing.
Okay.
And I think the problem with watching this for the first time, especially this being my number one most anticipated of the year, and knowing my love for Nolan films, I went in there with this mindset of, I'm going to find out the stuff. I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to understand everything that's going on. Just like when Cobb in Inception is explaining what Inception is, and you have that exposition, and you got a little of that, but it seemed like the exposition in this film was so complex and so quantum physics, and it was more than just, oh yeah, dream within a dream, and we have to use this, the kick, to wake up. Mm-hmm. Like, that's something that anyone can follow. This, you're getting into way more. You're talking about people from the future. You're talking about items from the future. You're talking about Tenet being a way to catch things as opposed to fire things. You're talking about inversion, where essentially you're going on to another plane of existence where you move in reverse and your lungs can't breathe, hence the masks, which is another Nolanism. So you take all of that into account, and it's just too much to try to think through, especially when all of this stuff is happening on screen and you talk about a Bond film. John David Washington is our introduction to a Black James Bond, because, I mean, say what you will, for at least half to two-thirds of the movie, he's playing James Bond.
Yes, I agree.
From the moment you get introduced to him, and he, you know, he's going into that opera house, you know, kicking ass, saving people, and then getting tortured, and then you have him showing back up in the nice suit, meeting with Michael Caine, basically playing a billionaire. He gets all the toys. you get the scene where he first meets with Elizabeth Debicki, which we'll talk about that in a little bit, yes. Because I know I have some frustrations with that casting as chemistry.
We definitely need to talk about that, yes.
So, I mean, from that initial scene, and then he beats up a group of thugs with a kitchen and, like, makes it look really easy.
And that was definitely one of the set pieces where I wanted more. You can feel Denzel in that piece. Yeah, where there's so much bravado there.
So that's what I mean. Like, I expected more. So I'm gonna backtrack a little bit. I'm just gonna say this, and we're gonna save the other part for spoilers. For John David Washington, for this to be his like leading role in a blockbuster film, I expected that. You know, I expected him to kick ass, take names later. You know, I expected that. But your father, granted, being the Denzel Washington, I expected more from you, especially from a director like Christopher Nolan. So that kitchen scene, as far as it being great, spoiler alert, it was great for me. It was a very great scene. I still expected and yearned more from this actor, you know, because your father, Equalizer, Training Day, your dad has done action films that are similar to what you've seen in the kitchen scene of this film. I wanted more, especially playing with the idea of invertness and just playing with time. I expected more. So don't get me wrong. Like I said, I have it at a 4 with you, Johnny. I have it at a 4, and I feel like you said, this was one of my top 3 anticipated films of this year. And I feel like after looking back on it and thinking about it, I had too much expectations on it. But at the same time, it still did a great job or a decent job, depending on how you look at it. It kept me going. But that's just how I felt about John David Washington in that scene. We'll go into more detail later.
So that scene in general, I feel like that is the closest you see John David Washington channeling his Denzel.
Yes.
Which is crazy to me because the thing about John David Washington is I've seen him give that Denzel sort of charisma.
Yes.
Whether it's on Ballers or Black Klansman.
Yes.
I've seen him give that charisma. So on one hand, I think some of it's the role. I mean, he doesn't even get a name. Yep. We've known that from the jump. He doesn't get a name.
That was my biggest concern about this film. Yep.
So he is supposed to be this stoic, like, and again, this is a trope in Hollywood, is you have your leading guy, just even keel, emotionless. And I think it's a thing. You had Brad Pitt and Ad Astra mm-hmm. playing that same type of role. And it's just one of those things where in these big action science fiction movies, your lead has to be this even keel, unemotional. He doesn't get high or low on the spectrum. He just does his job. And I think that was the only charisma you got. And it was because it was his, you got a little bit of that cockiness, that arrogance, where it's like, oh, you think you're going to take me out with 5 guys? Okay, I'm going to beat you up with a cheese shredder, some plates, and this meat pounder. Meat pounder,
yes.
And then I'm going to walk out and I'm going to fix my suit so she can see, like, yeah, I just whooped all of your guys' asses. So,
to that point, I'm going to dive a little bit deeper. So for John David Washington, we talked about his character, his charisma and stuff like that. In hot take, I don't know if both of you guys will agree with me. This is a small conversation before I jump into the next part I want to talk about. I don't think protagonists in this day and age needs to have that much background. What I mean by that is, and this is just a hot take, I don't know if you guys agree with me, most protagonists in most films nowadays are bland or even keel, basic, things of that nature. Now, you have some that are like a little bit different from others? Sure. But most of the protagonists that we have are bland. And the one person I didn't expect to see that come from was Christopher Nolan. That's why this movie is really at a 4 for me. It could have been a 3.5, but it was a 4 for me because it's like one of the biggest issues for this film is Christopher Nolan lets you latch onto the protagonist and make you feel the way they want you to as the film is progressing. This is the only,
I would say out of his leads, if you go down the list, Christopher Nolan in all of his films, his protagonist always has something to latch onto.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. You can argue maybe The Prestige or Memento, but not really. I
mean, even Prestige, you got the
That's what I'm saying. Wife. You could argue that, but for me personally, I had somebody trying to argue that, and I was like, I can see where you're coming from, but for me, for The Prestige and Memento, he still gets you to latch onto the protagonist. With this film, like you said, this name is called The Protagonist, right? You don't have anything to latch on. Oh, he's a CIA agent that's learning about inversion, right? And I think that's one of the biggest hindsights for me. However, our new Batman, may he recover for COVID-19 because he got tested positive for COVID-19 while filming Batman. I'm surprised. Not surprised.
I wasn't surprised, but I will say after watching it,
and I'm okay.
As much as I love John David Washington, and I'm so glad he got to play James Bond for half of the movie, I think you swap roles, and I hate that because that's a Hollywood trope.
Yes,
like you have your white leading man and then your sidekick. I mean, Lethal Weapon. I mean, you can go down the list throughout time.
Yes,
and I agree. This was John David Washington's shot, because before him you had Chadwick Boseman, we talked about before. You had Denzel. You got Morgan Freeman. You got Lawrence Fishburne. Maybe Wesley Snipes in some like B movies in the 90s.
B movies, yes, B movies.
And Blade. But this was his shot in a big Christopher Nolan production. And I don't put it all on him. I think Elizabeth Debicki was miscast.
Yes.
Which I think was a detriment to John David Washington. Because A, they don't have any chemistry whatsoever.
None.
And I think that's supposed to be his part of his driving force outside of he wants to save the world. But his other thing is, I want to make it right by this woman because I feel like what this guy has done to her is awful. And I want to make this guy pay on a personal level. I want to make him pay on a personal level. But they have no chemistry. Also, you take John David Washington, who is not a very tall guy, and you put him next to one of the tallest women in Hollywood?
6'3".
She's 6'3", right? Yeah, 6'2", 6'3".
And every time they're walking together and talking, you're like just like...
She looks like she's about to hug him and engulf him. Yes.
You're like, oh, they couldn't give that man some like platform shoes.
You do it to Tom Cruise, but you couldn't do it to my man John David Washington.
But I mean, that's the thing. You could even counteract if she was maybe 5'11", 6 foot. But you took the tallest woman in Hollywood and put her in heels.
You knew what you were doing.
Like, he looks like a child. He's supposed to be my James Bond. But, and like I said, they don't have that chemistry to where you really feel like he wants to help this woman. And so physically, no chemistry. Emotionally, between the characters, no chemistry. I did like the chemistry between Pattinson and Washington.
That was the driving force for me. I was just going to say that. That was the only driving force for me moving forward.
Before I even knew what we'll talk about in spoilers, before I even knew that, I was like, I like these two together.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Now, I'll talk about this in a moment, just in a moment, about Robert Pattinson, because I don't know if about you guys, but literally watching this film, I was 80 to 90% sure I was okay with him playing Batman after the first trailer of Batman. By the way, slight plug. If you have not seen the Batman's trailer recently, I think you should go and watch that trailer, because obviously this Batman reminds me of Batman Returns, but so much better. Again, whole different conversation. We're not going to get there.
Maybe like the best 2 minutes and 30 seconds of COVID entertainment thus far ever is that Batman trailer.
Again, this is not the podcast to talk about that. Even though I think that, again, with Brett, that was the best 2.5 minutes I've seen. But like I was talking about, this 80 to 90%, I was like, I'm okay with Robert Pattinson, but I want to see him into a Bruce Wayne role. Christopher Nolan, thank you. I just want to say I'm 100% back on this. Like, I was 80, 90% the way there, but now after watching him being, I would say, understudy for Bruce Wayne, because as you said, John David Washington was supposed to be our Bruce Wayne, debonair as Giants.
Yeah, but the thing too is they established that the Neil character, Pattinson's character,
yes,
is helping him, right, is guiding him.
That's what I'm saying. And he's
even
supposed to be an
understand. Washington is asks him early on, you know, why are you helping me? And he even asked him some questions about Tenet inversion. And from the jump, and that's something we'll get into in spoilers, It's mentioned multiple times throughout the film, and I hate that it took me the whole movie to go back and think about it. It's mentioned so many times. Don't try to ask too many questions. Don't try to understand it. Just feel it.
Yes.
And in particular, Pattinson's character says that multiple times. And Pattinson's character, as we all know, is playing Christopher Nolan. Because he puts himself in his movies. And Pattinson, from his hairdo to the way he dresses, he's playing Christopher Nolan. And he's telling the protagonist, the audience, don't try to think it. Don't try to understand it. Just feel it. Just watch my movie.
Are you okay with that? Because I feel like if a kid's movie does that to you, you're like, they're just...
Artemis Fowl, she tried to do that. And I was so mad with Artemis Fowl about that.
You want to just go, oh, that's too on the nose. I think I think we can kind of give Nolan kind of credit for that, because it does almost feel like a troll. Like that he's like, yeah, this movie's too complicated for you to just sit here and watch it and get it. So in order for you to be entertained, just let it float over you.
And
like
that was one of the things that, again, as we're talking about more cons, and again, this is not a movie that I think is bad, but we're talking about the cons more than the pros. For me, I think that was one of my biggest cons, was literally he was, after he got revived, spoiler alert, sorry about that. When he got revived, you've seen it in the trailer. If you watch the trailer, you know what I'm talking about. When he got revived and he's like, hey, the one word you need to know is Tenet. And the scientist is sitting there trying to explain what Tenet is. She's like, just roll with it. She basically tells him, just roll with it. And as the audience, that was us telling us, like, what I feel like what we did with Endgame. Don't think about it too much. Just roll with the punches. Everything's going to make sense later. Don't think about it too hard. Don't think about the plot holes enough. If you continue with this movie, everything's going to make sense. Which, I felt like, for Christopher Nolan, there's, again, we talked about this, certain directors that I don't expect a cop-out out of. And Christopher Nolan gave himself that cop-out. And I'm like, really, bro? Why did you give yourself that cop-out? But after going, like, not going back, but after watching the film to its very end, I'm like, that's why you didn't want me to think too hard about it. All of it makes sense now. Yeah. But, yeah, I thought it was good.
All right, with that being said, we're going to dive into a little bit of spoilers for the next 15, 20 minutes just to wrap things up. So we just ended talking about the don't try to understand it, just feel it, yes. Right? And is that really fair? Is that really fair of an adult audience? And once you find out the big, I'm doing quote hands, reveal at the end that Neil, who has been asked by Washington earlier in the film, well, who recruited you? And he's like, well, I can't tell you, or I'll tell you when it's time. And then he also asks him later on, you know, you knew it was me. Why didn't you tell me? And he's basically explaining to him all of this stuff about time and how you'll know when the moment's right. Yes. And you know when this is all right. And this is one of those moments. And Christopher Nolan's really good about giving you this at the end of a climax. He gives you something as an audience, whether you've felt any sort of emotions whatsoever, Dark Knight Rises, whether you felt any emotions whatsoever throughout the first 2 hours or so of the movie, once you get to that climax in that last 20 to 30 minutes, at some point, he's going to give you a moment or two where you're going to start, whether you're a tearjerker or not, you're going to start feeling something in your gut, and you're going to start feeling that emotion. And I think this was one of his better moments. And I think it couldn't have been delivered better than it was by Pattinson. And I think John David Washington, some of his best acting is also while he's hearing this explanation and is basically asking why, and like, can't you change things? And, you know, I think that's some of his best acting in this film as well. And Pattinson's character is playing it off like, hey, we're going to have a lot of fun together.
And to your point, that's why I feel like this film does something different than most films that try to say, hey, just wing it, just understand what's going on a little bit, and we're going to try to explain it. Artemis Fowl, as terrible as a film that was, it tried to do that in the middle and the beginning of the film, and it just flat out failed. It failed. And with Christopher Nolan, and I feel like he's done this better than most directors in this generation, in this ideal of decade of directors now. He tells you, hey, you know what? Don't worry about it just now, but throughout the later of the film, you're going to get your questions answered. To your point, Johnny, I was, for me, it was, I call it a mind-blowing moment as the movie kept progressing. For Artemis Fowl, I didn't feel that. I was like, okay, you try to explain the story, but it doesn't make sense. Like, you're not doing anything for the story. Whereas with Christopher Nolan, what he did with this film, you're sitting there like, whoa, 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 wow, okay. And then towards the end of the movie, you're like, no, wow, okay. And to your point with about Robin Pattinson and John David Washington crossing paths, I'm not gonna, are we in spoiler territory now?
Yeah.
So when Robert Pattinson gets shot and killed by the little, like, I call them, what do you call those guys? Heavies. The heavy in the film. You're like, no, that's Robert Pattinson. Wow. And you're trying to figure out why that happened. And you're like, oh, maybe he inverted himself to have that happen. No, he goes back and get inverted again to have that happen so he could save John David Washington through his moment.
Basically, I mean, they mention it multiple times. Multiple characters mention that nobody's better at picking locks than Neil.
Neil.
And he has to help John David Washington several times
to
with
pick
locks.
The lock, right.
And then this time, he has to not only pick the lock, but also take the bullet to the head.
Take a bullet for the head for John to save the world. And that's what I mean by, you can't ask for a better payoff than that. You know what I'm saying?
And him noticing the little coin on the backpack.
On the back of his backpack when he's trying to tell Robert, hey, don't go do this inversion. He's like, I got a job to do. Whatever happens, happens. And I have to do that. And he's like, and that's when, to Johnny's point, he was asking, well, how will I know? And he's like, well, you're the one who recruited me. And we were best friends by the time you sent me back. But, you know, whatever happens, happens. And I was like,
John David's like, so wait, I was towards the end at your beginning.
Yes.
And you were the begin, or you were towards the end of my beginning. And he says, yes, but we're going to have a lot of fun.
And I was like, only Christopher Nolan can do some crap like that. Only Christopher Nolan can say, hey, I can do this and make it fun. And that's why I was like, wow. At the end of the movie, after Travis Scott song for Tenet come out, called The Plan, I believe it's called, for the soundtrack, I was like sitting in my seat and I'm like, you know what, yeah, this is absolutely right.
And I'll say through the second watch, you start watching their interactions from early on, like once you know where this is going, you see their interactions early on where Neil shouldn't be this comfortable with him from the get-go, like this new guy learning. But he's just so comfortable and like telling him everything. And John Washington, his character, the protagonist, is very weary. Like, is this guy going to double cross me? What's his deal? To the point where they complete a mission and they're shaking hands. And Neil's like, I think this is the start of a good friendship.
He's finally seeing the protagonist's start.
As he knows him.
Yeah. I want to ask though, like, with all of the mental gymnastics that this film is making you do, like I think this is a harder text to crack than Inception.
Oh yeah,
I agree.
Interstellar as well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. This is I think this is kind of going next to, like, you know, I think Following is super hard to follow and kind of have a tactile feel for what's going on. Memento is the same way. Like, Memento starts to...
I think Memento, once you get a feel for it, and the other thing with Memento is you're in a much shrunken environment.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
You're only dealing with a handful of characters. And once you catch on to how the story is being told to you, then you can follow it. And then on watches after that, it only makes more and more sense, and you know how it's going, and you can kind of make your decisions based on that, and you kind of decide, it, you know, is it Shelby, like, mm-hmm. like what is the deal, and you can make your own decisions based on what you see and what you've learned.
Okay.
Same way with Inception. say what you will about the spinning top, that's the audience to decide.
Right.
Here, Nolan is definitively telling you, say what you will about all of the quantum time travel and the inversion and
all
everything.
All the different choices.
That's not it.
Yes.
But definitively, he's telling you the protagonist is the guy who created Tenet, and he's the one who started sending stuff back, and this is how it started. And he even tells Priya at the very end, when he just shows up in the car, he says, I'm the boss. I'm the protagonist
of
this story.
I'm the person who sends you to go get me.
He says, we've both been working for me.
Yes. And that's what I mean by, like, only certain directors can do that, you know? And for him to, I call it, you know, like, how I felt about The Gentleman. Yes, I'm going to use The Gentleman as an example. The Gentleman, I felt like with that film, you got a lot of, not answers, answers, but you got a lot of like, okay, I see where you're going with it. I don't know what's going on, but I can get that. The Gentleman still had questions to be desired at the end of the film, but it answered some of the questions you had at the beginning.
Well, you also had non-linear storytelling with a lot of exposition from Hugh Grant's character.
Yes.
That was not very entertaining.
No. Yeah. And so that's what I mean. Like, you could see that they were trying to do that with The Gentleman, but it didn't stick the landing for me. That's why it was at a 3. I think it's at a 3 out of 5 for me. Yeah, I think Gentleman was at a 3 out of 5 for me, whereas Christopher Nolan's like, you know what? Not only am I going to answer your question, I'm going to expand it a little bit just to give you the better answer of the question that you had in mind. Like, for instance, the scene where Neil and the protagonist, that's his name, unlike we were talking about, that's his name, where they were in the airport and Neil takes the mask off and it's like, okay, you know what you're supposed to be doing. My bad for trying to attack you, but go do what you need to do. I'll go help the self that's with me now, go help you navigate through all of that. And you're sitting there like, okay, I don't know who that was, and he let him go. Why did he let him go? And when it happens for the protagonist the second time around, you're like, wow, this all makes sense. And again, I can't commemorate Christopher Nolan being able to do that. Like you said with Memento, even though Memento, you need to watch it, I think, I don't know if you guys had to, I had to watch that film 3 or 4 times to catch it, to understand fully what was going on with Memento. With Christopher, with this film, I feel like I need to watch it probably 1 more time or 2 more times before I can actually be like, okay, I fully understand your time traveling concept. But from the first go round, this was, in my opinion, the most concise and most decision made Christopher Nolan film that I've watched in the last, actually almost his whole filmography, besides Memento.
It's I might differ with you there, because I do feel like the film isn't like it is like really, I just feel like impenetrable. Like when you start to like looking back at like the two big action set pieces, like the hallway fight,
yes,
and then the car chase. Playing those back in my mind, I'm like, does any of this like really make sense? Like, does it actually like work in terms of like the story itself? And I have issues there, and I think that's where, yeah, like kind of getting in there, a couple of viewings start to kind of weed it out, understand like how did his car wind up between the two cars when they were exchanging the whatever the heck it is, the MacGuffin anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to say too, we haven't mentioned the James Bond villain, which are always super
Kenneth
important.
Good.
Kenneth was really good.
I think he was in the movie that I wanted to see John David Washington in.
What movie are you talking about?
Well, just the fact that he's big, like Kenneth Branagh is going big with his character, and like every his emotions in just every scene, he's a pit bull in the movie.
I will agree. He is so much more than what you see in the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Like what you see in the trailer with the you chose the wrong profession, and then when you see him in the film, and I mean it's some heavy Bond, like. That's some heavy Bond. I mean, telling a guy what you're going to do to him to kill him. Like, it's brutal.
It's very heavy bondage. And how Kenneth explains it in detail, what he was going to do to John David Washington, was like, ah, okay. Like, most Bond films, you know, oh, I'm going to stick you on this table, Bond, and you're going to die.
And then I'm gonna tell you my plan.
Yeah. Kenneth doesn't explain his plan at all. He's just like, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to put your balls in the throat. Excuse me for the explicit commentary. But, yeah, I'm going to put your balls in your throat, and you're going to have to find out how to figure out how to get your balls out your throat. Like, wow, Kenneth, cool. But what's your plan? And he never explains it until, we're going to talk about her later, Elizabeth had to kind of like be the navigation for putting pieces together to explain where he's going with his plan. And again, like you said, Johnny, I think she's the weakest link out of this film. The weakest link.
And it fits in with kind of what we see in Nolan, where just female characters are kind of put to the wayside and they're just not really important. Which, you know, I think you can almost say too that might be part of the reason we get more of a, you know, even note John David Washington performance, is that, you know, looking back at his leads, his, you know, outside of McConaughey, like, his leads are
straightforward,
and like, they can't go high and low, because otherwise, you know, the ticking clock or the, you know, saving the world gets in the way, so they have to be neutral. And like, okay. And yeah, McConaughey's like the only time where Nolan's like allowed his leading man to like really be, you know, show the range of emotion. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I agree with that. Because even with the Dark Knight, it's, again, this is...
I mean, even go to Dark Knight, and, you know, he was down and he was out. Rachel died. And
he was still even
he was like, she was going to be with me. Alfred burned the note, and he goes right back off to save the world. Dark Knight Rises. Selina Kyle tells him, you don't know this city anything. I haven't given him everything. Not yet.
Not yet.
Still... Still goes out there with the bomb, does his job. I'll say Inception, you got a little bit with Cobb at the very end with the Marion Cotillard in the like fallen city in his
limo
mind.
Okay.
Not in the limo, when they're in the room, and he doesn't want to let her go, and she's finally telling him to like let me go, and she turns into ashes and falls away, and that's when he's like, oh shit, I need to go save Ellen Page. But I mean, usually, yes, the female characters in Nolan movies are, and that, I mean, go back to Memento, Carrie Ann Moss. I mean, he writes her as not a great human being.
Yeah.
Who's constantly taking advantage of our protagonist.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's not unheard of to have a weak female character. I find it kind of disbelievable that you have this super heavy with Kenneth Branagh, and she's just not near on even close to the same level.
And even when he gave her a monologue at the end of the film, right after Kenneth, and this is one thing I will say, they try to do a little bondage when John David Washington and I forgot old dude name is sitting in the cave, and Kenneth starts explaining what he's doing, and you're like, okay, cool. And then
Aaron Taylor. Just hiding behind that beard and that mask, man.
Aaron Taylor. I'm sorry. I'm today's years old when I just found out that was Aaron Taylor. Wow. Sorry.
Yeah, he was hiding behind a mask and a beard.
Yeah.
Wow. And a weird accent.
You could could not understand most of what Aaron Taylor.
No.
You just had that's no idea what he was saying.
That's why I'm mind blown that you just said that was Aaron Taylor. Wow.
Yeah, we got his tape
That's part of that, like, In the third act, and it's clear like Nolan didn't want to kind of release who that character was, because it kind of gives away the third act of the of the movie. But like, that character is then crucial in giving you a bunch of information about like why they're at the location, mm-hmm. what the plan is, and it's you can't understand.
This is our job. It's us too. We have to be at this point by this time.
Yeah,
and we gotta be. And on then the helicopters
once they get out, he's the one who's like. You get the piece, hide it, and then either kill yourself or eventually
I have to find you.
I'm gonna kill you.
I have to find you and kill you, you know? And to that point, that's why I mean, like, I feel like he felt on some tropes, and it, again, sorry, I'm being baffled by Aaron Taylor. Aaron Taylor had better exposition than Elizabeth, and that's bothersome to me. She was sitting on the yacht, and she's talking about her son, and you're like, okay, all right, cool. And then when she's explaining more to Kenneth, you're like, are you going to kill him or are you not? I don't care whether you go.
Little thing, and she had the little moment with John David earlier talking about how she felt bad about, for a moment, actually thinking about taking the deal and leaving. Mm-hmm. But then she saw the woman diving off the boat and...
come to find out that was her diving off
the boat. Oh, how empowered that woman must feel. And then she has that little short monologue, like, I can't let him die thinking he won, and mm-hmm. I'm not the same woman. I'm the scarred woman you left to die. And it didn't resonate at all. No. And, you know, then you have kind of a weird, you know, shot to the chest / suntan lotion skid off and then smash on the side of the boat.
really weird little sequence right there. How they wanted that to go.
And I know, you know, in most Christopher Nolan movies, you do have a little bit of humorous, even at the Batman movies, you've got Alfred giving you a little humor. I think in this one, the little humor he did try to throw in there didn't work.
For me, it was nearly a humorless film. I look at cheese graters.
Pattinson had a little bit.
Cheese graters are like my comedy standout of the film. Certainly, I look at cheese graters now. Yeah,
even the line that I bet you when they looked at it on paper, they were like, "This is gonna be funny." You've got this ultra heavy with Branagh saying, "Have you slept with my wife?" And then you're supposed to have this charismatic Washington saying like, "Not yet,
not yet,"
and it's supposed to come. And instead, you're just like,
Okay.
He doesn't Denzel that line. Denzel would have crushed that line.
Denzel would have crushed that. He would have given a little smirk and a little twinkle in the eye, and he probably would have been at eye level with him and said like, and he probably would have like leaned into it a little bit, kind of like leaned in. That's with what I'm saying.
He would have
gave
a little
like,
bit more, 110%,
and
a little
be like,
more extra.
Yeah, not yet, and then just kind of not.
And I think that comes with time, but. I feel like that comes with time, as John David Washington has, this is his second leading man role, right? From BlacKkKlansman and Tenet. I feel like, and like you said, this comes with time, and I feel like you gave him too much to chew on before he was ready for it. And again, like we talked about, I think Robert Pattinson, as much as I would love to see more black leads in film industry, I feel like if the roles were switched, this would have been... like, you could tell what the charisma would have been. Because, again, as I've been saying for a while now, and again, I'm going to just say this for the Man Ain't Talking listeners, Robert Pattinson, his stock is up. And I'm waiting to see what we get for Robert Pattinson. And all I needed to see was Christopher Nolan give me a little bit of Bruce Wayne, which he did with Robert. I'm all ears. I'm ready. I'm ready for 2021. Again, just be prepared, be cautious and safe with Robert Pattinson. But... I'm not mad about his choice with giving John David Washington a role, because out of all the directors, I would love to see Christopher Nolan give a black leading role to a black actor, and he gave it to him. But you're like you said, you wish a lot to be desired with this role. There's a lot of, again, we talk about a lot of things that were like problematic or not as great as we assumed with this film. But I will say Ludwig's score, phenomenal. The cinematography, phenomenal. I mean, you get that with any Christopher Nolan film. And I still feel like this is one of the most beautiful, like, beautifully shot films that Christopher Nolan has made. And I still would watch this again. Like, and this is crazy. Again, we were talking about he's made 11 films now. This is probably, for me, 5 or 6. Almost every film he watched, besides Dark Knight Rises, and I have my transgressions with it, are rewatchable. And not many directors can say, hey, I made 11 films and every single one of them is rewatchable, you know? Mm-hmm. And this is an above average Christopher Nolan film, and I would definitely watch it again.
Could we real quick too, just go back to the Ludwig and that score. Like, are we missing Zimmer?
No, I'm not. I'm not.
I really dig this score.
I think the score is super effective.
But I can't hum anything.
But I'll
tell you this. I don't have there's not a track on there like Time from Inception.
So I would agree.
And there's not a track like there, and I can't think of the name of the track, but from Interstellar, the docking track.
So to your point, I'm not mad that Ludwig is the composer for this film. I think Hans Zimmer is just like, I probably didn't want to do this film. But I agree that there's not a monumental, oh my God, I would definitely put this in my list of music scores to listen to. But it's still one of those music scores where I was like, okay, if you would have told me that this was made from Han, okay, I would have never known it. I would have wished that Han would have gave me that one track, that one score that would have been like, wow, this compiles what you're looking for. But again, Ludwig does a phenomenal job. Another composer that is up on the works, I will say that.
Absolutely.
How about Michael Giacchino on that Batman score, though?
Yeah.
100%. Can't wait for that sound.
I need a soundtrack for that, like, yesterday, to be honest. But a whole different conversation.
All right. Any final thoughts before we get out of here?
So many.
Like, Dimple reminded me of Tenet forever. Of a... is she Indian? I'm sorry. Is she Indian?
Who?
Dimple Kapadia.
Yeah, the woman who plays Priya. Yeah, yes. she's only done some small stuff.
She reminds me of Indian Felicia Rashad, and she gave me that really great, like, homey kind of relationship and that kind of idea of this film and Tenet. I love Dimple. I wish we'd have saw more of her instead of the little exposition that she gave us.
Because she's clearly M in the movie, right?
Yes. Yeah,
just spot on.
We didn't get much Q. We got a lot of Q in the trailers.
Yeah.
But not
which like, that's the funny thing. Like, you almost have to give that Q scene in the trailer to just be like, hey, look, we're going to explain everything. And literally the explanation is, just feel it. You'll get it.
Yep.
Like, I don't have a lot of tools for you. Just get just it.
Roll with it. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But phenomenal. Score, I already talked about. The filmography was also a phenomenal. I wish the script was a little bit better, though. That's just me.
Well, I mean, big portions of it, you're not supposed to understand what they're saying. I mean, Brett and I talked about it. The whole scene on the skiffs, you don't hear a word. You don't understand anything. A word.
And I
think that's sound design, though, but that's a whole different conversation.
And for me, that's like a Bond scene. It's just like, look at these rich people do rich people things. And like, that's all I really felt like I was supposed to get out of that, like, kind of recontextualizing that scene where I couldn't hear what they were saying, so I didn't know motives. I was just like, oh, okay, I'm just watching rich people sport. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I'm cool with that. Looks gorgeous. Again, you know, yeah, the Hoyt Van Hoyten, you know, cinematography, like, that seems like now that's locked in as Nolan's guy moving forward. Looks gorgeous. I mean, Nolan knows how to shoot. We all know that.
We all know that, yes. By the way, I watched Dunkirk again, and I'm like, yeah, I understand why you keep winning. You keep getting nominated for cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
These films are beautiful.
But yeah.
Nevertheless. What about you, Johnny?
Yeah, I mean, final thoughts. I mean, I don't think I left off anything that I didn't already say. I wish I got more Pattinson, because I just love that character. I love that ending. I think second watch was better. I look forward to more. I don't know how good a rewatch is going to be at home.
Sorry to interject here, but that's kind of the last question I wanted to ask. If we were in like a non-COVID world and we had our Alamo season pass, how many times would you have seen this in the...
Oh, three times.
In the first week and a half or so.
Yeah.
Three times.
Probably three.
Yeah. And now, you know, we all saw it once. You've already seen it twice there, Johnny. I don't know that I'm going to, like, do another theater visit to see it, but I really want to. But I know that, yeah, like, as soon as that sucker hits home video, boom, boom, I'm getting, like, a second and third view.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to rewatch. I'm just not sure how... Like, is it going to hold up on a home viewing? Because I'll say, like, I love Dunkirk. Saw it 70 millimeter in theaters.
I was disappointed watching it.
Amazing. And, you know, bought the 4K disc. And watching it at home, it's just not the same effect. Mm-hmm. And I have a good system at home.
Yeah.
But I'm still, that's what I'm saying, I'm still disappointed by the sound system that I have, because I watched Dunkirk in IMAX. I watched it in IMAX at the Bullock Theater right across the street from UT in Austin. And I'm sitting there watching it, was it last night or a couple of nights ago? Whenever it was. I'm sitting there, wow, I wish this was back in theater so I can rewatch it again, because it does not have the same pop. I feel like I'm going to feel the same way with Tenet, but I'm still going to watch it.
And that's why I feel like Nolan is that filmmaker that's like, yeah, my movies are for the cinema. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, I've got a great set. I got an OLED. I got a 3.1 with some nice towers, center, big old, you know, big booming sub, and it's not going to feel the same.
No.
Of course, I can always crank up the decibel levels on my center channel so I can maybe hear them talk, but
do we want to piss our neighbors off? That,
you know. All right, folks. With that being said, that is going to end our review of Tenet. I'm sure there's a million other things to talk about Tenet, but we're going to wrap it up for today. Without further ado, Julian, where can the kids find you?
Yes, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at King Julian Owens. Yeah, you can find me on there. And then where can the kids find you, Johnny?
Johnny, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Johnny the Wonder. You can check out my Letterboxd reviews, lists, rankings, all of that at Johnny Boy Wonder. Letterboxd is awesome. You should check it out. Brett, Letterboxd is going to be his one social media platform. Brett, where can they find you?
Find me on Letterboxd. B. Leipziger. I'm very active on there. Love making lists. Got some new lists flowing, so.
I was just going to say, what's your recent list?
I just did a list for live-action Disney remakes.
Oh, okay.
In preparation for eventually watching Mulan.
I don't know if I'm going to pay $30 when I have $7 in the bank for it. But that's a whole different conversation.
All right, folks, there we go. We will see you guys in 2 weeks. Auf Wiedersehen. See y'all later.
Later, guys.